Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll learn about the history of influential female cellists from an influential female cellist who lives here in Iowa. But first, if spending a cold, dreary November evening reading stories that will make it hard for you to sleep sounds like a good idea, Benjamin Percy is your man. He has just published a collection of short stories called Suicide Woods, and he'll be in Iowa City at Prairie Lights Bookstore Friday, November 8th, that's tomorrow at 7 p.m., reading from this collection of stories. And Percy may be best known for his stories and his novels, but he also has legions of fans in the comic book world. He's written Green Arrow, Teen Titans, and the James Bond comic book series. He also wrote Marvel's first scripted podcast, Wolverine, The Long Night, and we're going to talk about all of that. Hello, Ben.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for being back on the show. And let's start with this collection of short stories. You have been focusing on well, at least in publishing books, not just comic books, but books. In the last few years, you've been focusing on your novels. What made you want to bring out a collection of short stories?
Short stories are my first love. I started off writing them exclusively before taking on the big game of the novel. And, you know, there's something about them that allows me to be a little more impressionistic and experimental. It also feels a little bit more like art for art's sake. It truly is about the love of the game when I'm writing short fiction, because it's sad to say, but to some degree, it's equivalent publishing a book of short stories right now is somewhat equivalent to publishing a book of poems.
All right. So this is a literary, people like to read short stories, writers like to write them, but the general public doesn't necessarily pick up collections of short stories very often is what you're
saying.
It's a
curious thing, right? Because we live in this culture where everybody's attention is constantly diverted, and you'd think that they'd really enjoy maybe like these little nuggets of storytelling where they could spend, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes with a story and you know, be fully satisfied before moving on to the next.
Right. It seems like a good idea. One of the stories in this collection is a story that you wrote that really gave you inspiration, eventually became your novel, The Darklands. And I'm curious about that process. Is that something that you've done before with short stories, where you've played with an idea and then it builds in your mind and turns into something bigger?
Yeah, sometimes the process is gradual and generative. I wrote a short story called Into the Woods, which was not a musical. and that story eventually became The Wilding, which was my first novel.
And I would like to see a musical adaptation of The Wilding. I think that that's a really good idea.
Lots of singing bears.
Right. Yeah.
And hunters in buffalo plaid dancing about. So, yeah, I wrote this story called The Balloon, and it stuck in my head, and I kept turning it over and over and, you know, playing around with its end of the world possibilities. And it took on a much larger canvas in the Deadlands. And, you know, that sort of stuff is happening all the time. For example, I have a novel called Red Moon, and that novel was actually initially a comics pitch for Vertigo. Now, that comics pitch didn't work out, and I ended up, you know, my agent was like, you know what, I really like this idea, let's play with it in a different way, and I ended up writing a novel from there.
Tell me a little bit about the process that brings about a short story for you, because there is, at the heart of each one of these short stories, there is really this singular, horrifying idea. So how does this work?
Well, you know, it's different for each one, but let me say that if you look at a story like The Cold Boy, I wrote that while I was living in Iowa. And oftentimes an image is what first sparks a narrative for me. And in that case, when I was in Ames, there were two images in particular. And one of the images had to do with crows. You know, this is true of a lot of Iowa, that a lot of crows winter there. And
right.
So the sky can sometimes, you know, seem almost Hitchcockian in the way it's seething with all these blackbirds. And
right. Especially on the Iowa State University campus, for sure.
That's right, yeah. And they actually have, this is a creepy sort of thing, but they have playing from loudspeakers on all the buildings and in the parking ramps. Some people say it's the sound of an owl. Other people told me it was the sound of tortured crows. So you'll be walking through this, you know, picture perfect campus, and then you'll hear, you know, shouting from the rooftops, you know, the sound of tortured crows. It's meant to scare them off the rooftops. So anyways, this one time I walked out of a Christmas Eve service in Ames, and I heard this muttering sound, this sort of, you know, and I looked up and down the street, and every single tree, which should have been stripped of its leaves, appeared to be sort of blackly leafed at that time. And it turned out that every single tree up and down the street was full of crows. And I kept hearing that noise, you know, and I turned around and found on the roof of the church that it was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of crows were roosting there. So part of the story has to do with that. Another part of the story has to do with something a little sad, and that is that a kid, this is, I guess, 8 years ago, that a college kid walked out of a bar in Ames and was never seen again. And so there were, you know, search teams in the woods, in the fields, there were dogs baying, there were police everywhere. And one time when I was walking across Iowa State's campus with Rick Bass, another writer who was there visiting, we looked down on the campus lake, which was frozen, and there were all these cops on the lake, and they had cut out circles in the ice, and they were diving down into it, looking for his body. They thought he might have fallen through. So that image, which from this angle on the hill, the lake looked like a skull because of the holes carved into it. And I was just thinking about the pillars of light, right, that would be coming down through those holes. And, you know, the possibility of a body turning through like one of those columns of light. And Rick Bass actually turned to me and said, you know, we should really write a story about this. And we ended up both using that image in different stories. And writers are oftentimes doing this sometimes in a protective sort of way. Like a writer will be like, that's mine. Or, you know, do you want to arm wrestle over this one? But in this case, Rick Bass and I were like, we both should explore this really haunting idea in another capacity. So the Cold Boy is what came out of that one.
As a parent, I find nothing to be more horrifying than something terrible happening to a child, which, of course, is what happens in The Cold Boy. An uncle is taking care of his nephew and isn't paying close attention. And in the very beginning of the story, the nephew falls through a hole in the ice. He is recovered from that hole in the ice. And I won't tell you anything else about what happens in the story. Does it almost feel cruel as a parent yourself to play with that kind of horror, knowing how visceral it is?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the reasons that people read horror, or one of the reasons that people write horror, is that you are, you know, you're channeling unease in some way. And sometimes it's a personal unease. Sometimes it's a cultural unease, a political unease, but sometimes it's a personal unease. And you're wrestling something with something that is bothering you. And nothing scares me more than some harm coming to my kids. And so Cormac McCarthy said something similar when he was writing The Road. He said the initial idea for The Road came to him when he was in a hotel one night with his son. And he heard something outside, and he went to the window, and he looked out on the hills, and he imagined them covered in flame, and thought to himself, like, what if the world is ending, and I have this boy beside me, and all I, you know, my whole life will shift to, like, keeping him alive, despite the fact that the world is falling apart. And his story arose from that. And in the same way, you know, where I think that, you know, there's something almost satisfying about being able to brave a roller coaster, being able to brave a haunted house, to be able to emerge from it out the other side and feel like you've wrestled with something larger, you've wrestled with some larger fear, but emerged from it safely. There's that same satisfaction you get when reading a horror novel or a horror story.
And obviously some people love to be scared. Other people avoid it like the plague, don't watch horror movies, don't read horror stories. You are drawn to this. You always have been as a reader and definitely as a writer. Have you thought about why you enjoy that experience so much? Or maybe it's not even enjoyment. What do you get out of it?
It's just the way I'm hardwired. But I think that there is something to be said about this moment, right? Because we live in what is being referred to as a golden age of horror. And the last time that that happened was the 80s. And if you think about all the Cold War paranoia of that time and some of the economic uncertainty, I don't think that, you know, it's a coincidence that right now we have something similar going on with this surge of horror, especially in cinema. You know, if you look at what Jordan Peele is doing with movies like Get Out or movies like Us, right? There is something to be said about the cultural divisions and political divisions in this country. You know, the sense of, you know, what's true, what's false. All these questions are feeding into our art.
In your
collection, it's the right time to be reading and writing horror. In other words,
in your collection of stories, because you get to play with so many themes, you get to play with some of the sort of more mundane ideas behind horror. I mean, there's one story that's basically a murder mystery. It's sort of a rapid mm-hmm. fire. You know, we see this dead body, and throughout the story, we figure out where that dead body came from, and you've got a big reveal that's a little bit shocking. Mm-hmm. And then in your novels, you've played a lot with the supernatural. Does writing short stories, does that give you a freedom that you don't have when you commit to a big idea, that you get to play with all different kinds of horror?
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's again, the stakes are more artistic for me. And oftentimes what drives me to write a short story is an artistic challenge or an aesthetic challenge. So in the case of that story, Suspect Zero, and I have another one in there that does something similar, Dial Tone, what I set out to do was challenge myself. I had a hurdle, a stylistic hurdle I wanted to cross. And that is that, you know, it occurred to me when I was watching movies like 21 Grams or when I was reading a novel like Mrs. Bridge, these are stories that are non-linear. They are achronological. They are modular units instead of chronological and causal. And so I wanted to write a story that created sort of a mosaic pattern. And I thought that the mystery would be the perfect place to do it, to have a murder mystery that had a shattered frame so that the audience was a co-detective.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Benjamin Percy. His most recent book is a collection of short stories. It's called Suicide Woods. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Central College and Humanities Iowa, presenting the new podcast, Mid-Americana, Stories from a Changing Midwest. New episodes from Season 1 are available at midamericana.com or wherever podcasts are found.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me is Benjamin Percy. He is best known for his novels such as Red Moon. He's also a very popular comic book writer. He's written Green Arrow, Teen Titans, and the James Bond comic book series. His most recent publication is Suicide Woods. It's a collection of really, truly terrifying short stories. He'll be in Iowa City on Friday night reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore at 7 p.m. And he is with me now. And I don't want to talk too much about the stories because they're all this little perfect, you know, encapsulation of some horrifying idea, and I don't want to give away any of your secrets. But one of the stories in the collection really brings to life a fear that I think so many people have, which is that fear of being buried alive. And
that's right.
I'm curious about your inspiration for that story. Was that at the core of your inspiration? Like, oh, people are terrified of this idea. How can I make it real?
Well, oftentimes I am sort of surveying my friends and saying, what do you fear most? In one occasion, I was asking about which animals or creepy crawlies do you fear most? And bats seem to be the standard response. And I ended up putting a major bat scene into my novel, The Deadlands, as a result of that. But in this case, the primary inspiration for the story Suicide Woods was an article I read in The New Yorker. And it was all about the suicide forest of Japan. And there is a kind of suicide culture in the country. And sometimes it's because of dishonor or shame that people end their life. And sometimes they jump in front of the subway car. And sometimes they go to the shadow of Mount Fuji, and there is a forest there. where, and this is, you know, quite ghostly to imagine, but you can find a lot of bodies. Sometimes they're dangling from trees, and sometimes they're, you know, half buried in moss, decomposed. And the idea of this place, this sort of eerie, mystical, ghostly place, fascinated me. And I ended up transporting that idea into our own country and connecting it to what I think is sort of like an, I guess you could say that this is a very anxious and even depressive moment, it feels like. And I don't know if social media is partly to blame for that and the way that we're sort of fed too much information in a day, or I don't know if it has to do with the political climate, but I think we're living in a moment of heightened anxiety and depression. And I wanted to tie those two things together because this one thing is very ephemeral, right? The sense of us being sort of scattered mentally and uncomfortable mentally. And then the other thing is you want to have a physical analog to that. So I have a place, Suicide Woods, which I planted just outside of Portland, Oregon. But it also, that was one of those aesthetic challenges. I wanted to write a story that had a we to it, that had a collective consciousness. And so the story is told with a we that, you know, every now and then branches out to follow individual characters.
But it makes you feel sucked into this horror scene.
Yeah, it makes you participatory in the same way that I was talking about that detective story, right?
Where right.
Because it has this fragmented design, this achronological design, you're puzzle piecing it together yourself and becoming like an investigator.
We are talking about Benjamin Percy's latest short story collection. It's called Suicide Woods. And Ben, I was spending some time on your website in preparation for this interview, and I noticed an interesting pattern on the website. I was looking at some of your film adaptations, TVs, etc., TV
right.
scripts, and there's a sentence that comes up a lot as you write about these projects. So The Wilding was going to be a movie twice, and then the last sentence of this description
right.
says, but alas, on both occasions, the movie died in development hell. Red Moon was going to be a television series, but alas, it died in development hell. This is not the, I haven't read them all. So tell me what you've learned from your experiences writing for Hollywood. This sounds frustrating.
Well, for the third time, maybe the third time will be the charm, Red Moon is in development. It's not in development hell yet. Hopefully this time we're going to go the distance. But the thing about Hollywood is that, right, they love you and they love you and they love you until they don't anymore. And I've had a lot of different occasions where I'm in the room in Hollywood or where I'm on the phone and where projects are being developed. And sometimes I'm a producer on them and sometimes I'm a writer on them. And sometimes they're just optioning my material and having somebody else take it on. And in all of those occasions, I have learned not to get too excited because things often fall apart. Right now, for instance, I have the Russo brothers are the people behind Avengers Endgame and Infinity War. You know, they've optioned my next novel trilogy that's coming out in 2021. And, you know, if something happens, great. If not, that's fine because I know how, you know, I've been on this roller coaster before.
So, I mean, does it, why keep getting on the roller coaster? I mean, obviously the payoff could be huge, but does it make you rethink it and think, you know what, maybe I'll just put my energy in other directions?
Well, I would say that, you know, that's the biggest game there is, making a movie, making a TV series. So it's incredibly enticing to have that kind of audience. But I've learned not to make that my primary focus. So there was a time there where I spent a year, you know, principally trying to get a TV show made. I sold it to the station Stars, the network Stars, and it was in development and it was about the oil fields of North Dakota. And the, you know, the Bakken and all the crime and madness happening up there. And then another show came out on ABC before we could put our pilot forward. And it was about the exact same thing. And it starred Don Johnson and it was terrible and it got canceled. And so they shelved our show because they're like, well, they already tried it and it didn't work. And that process was just so blisteringly frustrating for me that I decided, you know what, from now on, this is my, hobby. So like cross stitching or, you know, being a, being a jam enthusiast or whatever. That's sort of how I treat Hollywood now, where my focus is comics, my focus is novels, my focus is podcasts, and then there's this Hollywood junk over here. And if it works out, fine.
With all of the different streaming services, I mean, we've seen kind of an explosion in projects that are actually making it to somebody's eyeballs. Different projects are making a little less money than they used to, but they're actually getting made and getting out there. Does that feel exciting? Does that make you think, well, maybe it doesn't always have to be just a cross-stitch hobby?
Well, I was talking to my agent the other day, and she was like, you need to hit this boom while it's happening, because everybody's expecting within 3 years that things are going to bust, because right now there's this ridiculous proliferation of streaming services where, like, everything, General Mills probably has a streaming service, you know, Foot Locker probably has a show that's about to drop, and people are going to get $7.99 to death as a result of this. Like, there's only so many subscriptions you can tolerate. So they think that this is a moment of speculation, like frontier times, and then 3 years from now, 5 years from now, it's all going to collapse and things are going to get bundled, and essentially we're going to get the streaming equivalent of what our cable packages were. So, yes, I definitely do feel like, you know, I should maybe be trying a little bit harder right now, and I am working on several projects, and we'll see what happens with them.
It strikes,
there's something just so much more fun about working on comics and on novels.
I don't have any of that.
You know, the Hollywood madness.
Right. Well, let's talk about comic books, because that's such an interesting process. It's so collaborative. And you as a writer, I mean, when I look at a comic book, there aren't that many words to comic books. So tell me about that process as a writer and how it's different from writing one of your novels or even a short story.
Sure. So I probably write more than other comics writers. Not Alan Moore. He's known for being especially loquacious in his scripts, but I tend to draw out panel by panel, like extensive descriptions of what's seen, what that camera angle might be. Think of it like an aggressive screenplay. So maybe like the rain is pouring down diagonally in this alleyway. I might detail what graffiti is on the wall. There's, you know, a dumpster with the lid thrown back. That might be important in a moment when something leaps out of it and walking towards this dumpster, and there's bags of trash that are leaking, and maybe there's a rat scuttling about, and walking towards the dumpster is like a giant guy wearing a hood and we can't quite see his face and blah, 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 blah. But it's not just that panel description, which nobody else is going to see except for the artist. Then I'm also writing in dialogue and narration. So for me, it's like a really inexpensive way of making a movie, like a slow movie, panel by panel.
How are comic book readers different from other readers?
They're very different. And you know, on the one hand, it has to do with comprehensiveness, too, because it's actually a really sophisticated way of reading when it's textual and visual literacy combined. Like, the way in which things are put together on the page becomes vitally important to the sort of larger point of the story. And so much happens sometimes in between panels, in the gutter between panels, and you're making these imaginative leaps. So it has to do with that, but it also has to do with the way in which they encounter the story, and that a lot of these characters have been around for 80 years and they belong to the fans, right? So the fans have an ownership, and oftentimes, you know, I've had to learn to code shift between my literary events and my comic book events, because like at first I would be like, you know, standard, a comic book event would be like a literary event. I go to a bookstore and it's Masterpiece Theater. You know, that doesn't work when you go to a Comic-Con. Like, I had to change from Masterpiece Theater with, like, my pipe and my velvet robe over to, like, professional wrestler monologuing. So I learned that I had to become, like, Macho Man Randy Savage. And instead of being like, oh, yes, well, the thematic reason that I'm doing this, instead I'm like, oh, yeah, and then Green Arrow, he's going to kick some. I can't say that on public radio, can I? But you get what I'm saying. And then, you know, the audience, like, you get a polite audience. They politely applaud in a bookstore and ask thoughtful questions, whereas like the comic fans will rise to their feet and start like, you know, cheering and falling to the aisles, having seizures of excitement, and maybe they'll hit each other with aluminum folding chairs afterwards. So, it's a much different sort of vibe.
Well, and it's, you are working with such incredibly different characters in your different comic books, too. I mean, that feels like almost completely different genres.
In some ways, no. Like right now, I am part of the New Dawn of X. So the X-Men have been revitalized, rebooted over at Marvel, and I'm part of that. So I'm writing X-Force, which is the Black Ops team, and I am also writing Wolverine, who is my spirit animal. And if you think about Wolverine, right, if you think about some of the elements that surround this character, the idea of man and the wild and man, about the sort of savageness contained within us, that is something that I have explored in my novels and in my stories and carries over to my work in comics.
That's very different from writing James Bond.
Right. Who is the very, well, actually, you know what? I would say if you look a little closer at Bond, there's some interesting parallels. And that is that here is this veneer, right? James Bond appears to be like the epitome of cool. But the thing about Bond is, and this is more the novels, and I guess some of the Daniel Craig stuff in the movies, but Bond is actually really messed up. And he's a guy who carries all of his scars on the inside, right? So there's an equivalency to Wolverine there, because Wolverine, because of his healing powers, he doesn't scar and he doesn't die, right? He can be tossed off of a skyscraper. He can be mauled by a bear and he comes right back. But he carries horrible emotional scars. And that's, you know, he's kind of a cousin to James Bond in that particular way.
Interesting. I want to talk about, before we run out of time, your Wolverine podcast. So this was Marvel's first scripted podcast. And for people who haven't heard it, tell me what it's like. What's the concept behind it?
So, you know, people are like, Wolverine has a podcast? What does that mean? Is he like, hey, everybody, you should buy this beef jerky. It's really good. And, you know, talking to different guests. It's not that. Wolverine... It's like a TV show, so you're just listening to it. So it's an audio drama. So what I did was I borrowed from shows that I thought worked, you know, like S-Town and Serial, and even Homecoming. And what those shows have is an interrogative format, right? Like there's an investigator, or in the case of Homecoming, a therapist, and they're asking questions and they're getting stories in response. So I have an investigative team, a group of federal agents, and they are investigating a series of murders in Burns, Alaska. And Wolverine turns out to be one of the subjects, the suspects. So that is the basic premise of it. It has a lot in common with True Detective in that way, the first season of Wolverine. And you can listen to this for free wherever podcasts are streamed.
And there's a second season on its way, right?
The second season is out.
Okay.
And it takes a very different approach. We didn't want to just rinse and repeat. So in the first season, you know, people were sort of hunting Wolverine. And in the second season, Wolverine's at the heart of the story instead. But man, it was such a challenge writing for audio in that, you know, here I am taking a visual medium comics and I'm translating it to, you know, your auditory senses. So all these questions rise up like, how do you write a fight scene in audio and not totally confuse everybody?
Do you find yourself going back to like old radio dramas to figure out how they were doing it, or are you reinventing the genre?
In a way, we're kind of reinventing the genre because the technology right now is so sophisticated. You can do crazy stuff. You know, this isn't just people like clacking, you know, coconuts together to make horse hooves. Like we've got three-dimensional sound. We're on location oftentimes out in the woods or in a cave when we're recording. We have all of, you know, we're doing cool things with memory. So let's say a detective is interrogating somebody. As that person starts to tell the story, the past will start to surge up and infect the present. And eventually the past will take over. So like if they're telling a story about being at sea and about finding this abandoned vessel, fishing vessel, and exploring it and finding a bunch of bodies in the hold, that's one of the scenes in there. Then that whole moment with the shushing waves and the boom of the surf, right, that whole moment takes over, and the squeak of rubber soles upon the deck. So it's a really cool process in that we're kind of, we're figuring things out along the way, like what is possible?
Putting so much of your energy into such different places, like the comic books, the podcast, the novels, the short stories, the TV, the movies, What do you do to protect yourself as a creative person from getting pulled in too many different directions?
That is a concern, and sometimes it just has to, you know, it's just me saying no to something that comes up. But what I generally do is I'm excellent about sort of time management and about focus. So I might spend a week just working on a novel, and I might spend 2 days working on a comic, and I might spend my afternoons after I walk the dog sort of shifting my focus and working on this project. So usually I'm not just like rolling forward with 15 documents open on my desk and writing with, you know, two different hands at the same time on different stuff. I'm immersing myself and trying to find a singular focus even as I'm juggling different projects.
Well, Ben Percy, thank you so much for talking with me again.
Thanks for having me on.
Benjamin Percy, his latest publication is Suicide Woods, a collection of short stories. He'll be in Iowa City tomorrow night at Prairie Lights Bookstore at 7 p.m. Prepare to be frightened. Coming up in just a moment, we'll learn about influential female cellists. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.